today, indeed, I'll be talking about some work I've been doing over basically the last year, but the ideas that underlie the topic I'll talk about today have been, at least I've been thinking myself about them for a while. And basically, indeed, it's a connection between a one-dimensional quantum many-body system, the SYK model, has been around for almost 10 years now, so I assume that some people will have heard talks about it. And it's usually described, indeed, as a model for a low-dimensional holography, which is the mapping between a quantum many-body system and typically entity sitter space. But it's a model that's actually soluble, which is why it's interesting on the quantum side, meaning on the dual to the gravity side. And because it's soluble, it means that you can sort of check the duality in many ways. It turns out that in a particular limit, the SYK model, which I'll mention in a second, you can actually obtain explicit formulas. And I noticed, at least when I was looking at the formulas, that they have a structure that actually points to a relationship with de Sitter space instead of anti-de Sitter space. And I'll try to explain today at least part of where that's coming from. And that's, of course, an interesting thing to at least get to the bottom of, because again, we live in a space with positive cosmological constant. If we can do something analogous to ADS CFT, but now with positive cosmological constant, that's actually a valuable step forward. And it turns out that essentially the duality that sort of seems to be emerging is a duality between still in low dimensions, but actually it goes all the way sort of up to 3, and if you work hard enough, you may even be able to sort of connect it with 4D gravity. But again, in one dimension, indeed, is this SYK model, and I'll explain in a second what double scaled means. Turns out that there's a correspondence with two-dimensional gravity. It's essentially sort of a form of Liouville gravity. I'll explain what that theory is also. I will not be able to cover all the relationships here. I'll mostly actually be talking about essentially going between, surprisingly perhaps, three-dimensional gravity and this one-dimensional system. Now, the fact that one can study these dualities in part is governed, or at least helped, by the fact that 3D gravity, if you consider pure gravity, is a soluble model. And also, Liouville gravity is a soluble model. And the double-scaled SYK model. So these are all soluble models. So you can actually study these links in a lot of sort of explicit detail. Nonetheless, making the dictionary will still be somewhat challenging. And indeed, I'll try to explain some elements of it. So let me just get started. Many of you may have seen, again, this SYK Hamiltonian before. It's built up from a bunch of oscillators. These are fermionic oscillators, Majorana. Degrees of freedom, quantum mechanical, meaning it's just a Hamiltonian, and there's a time direction. But crucially, at least these couplings, indeed they couple, have a pth order interaction, and the j's are Gaussian random variables with a Gaussian a mean, or at least the average explained here. And it turns out that this model, again, in the large n limit, is a soluble model. And like most large N theories, the way you kind of sort of summarize sort of the large N dynamics often is by going to some kind of collective field. In this case, it's, say, the two-point function summed over all the oscillators as a function of time. So this is a variable that depends on two coordinates, namely the two positions, the two time locations of these fields psi. And then it turns out that you can kind of do a little trick where you essentially, look at the time evolution with the Hamiltonian, you average over J, and you get an effective theory that's actually bilocal in terms of time. And then, indeed, in the appropriate large N limit, it turns out that this variable big G can be written as the exponential of a variable little g, and that little g turns out to have this particular action. You can sort of go through the basically the path integral derivation, and arrive at an action that looks like that. So this is, in a quick sort of summary, one of the connections that are already mentioned. although at this point it's basically claimed that this G describes an effective low energy degree of freedom of that particular quantum mechanics system. But it already gives a bit of a hint that there is a two-dimensional conformal field theory that connects with the SYK model, because this looks like the Liouville two-dimensional theory. It has a coupling constant, which is given by N, and this number P is the order of the interaction. And what I mean by double scaled, and let me write it somewhere on the board. I'll go here. So I'm going to take N to infinity, P to infinity, but there's a number that I'll call lambda, which is 2p squared over n, which is fixed. Later, I'll also introduce a number q, which is e to the minus lambda. So these two quantities are finite.
What do you do with calligraphic j?
The calligraphic j here is that that number that sits here.
It's fixed.
It's fixed, right. So it just sets a scale. And it's true a little bit later on. So J sets, for example, the scale for temperature. So the dimensionless number for temperature is beta times J, where beta is the inverse temperature. A lot of studies in SYK are at low temperature. Later on, actually, I'm going to be thinking about this theory at very high temperature. Essentially at infinite temperature, and we'll see why that's possible.
Sorry, to get that action, you integrate over J's, like each of the Hamiltonian?
That's correct. And indeed, the fact that this is bilocal is because of the Gaussian integral over J's. And this e to the G exponent of G is basically the product of two Hamiltonians. By the way, you could try to solve this theory. And one way in which people solve Liouville theory is essentially just by exponentiating this interaction. You put this in the path integral. This is a Gaussian measure, and you just exponentiate the interaction. That leads to diagrammatic rules, which I'm going to describe as well. Those diagrammatic rules, you can actually get them directly from the SYK Hamiltonian itself, meaning you write down the Hamiltonian, and you start computing moments of the Hamiltonian, say the trace of the Hamiltonian to some power. Since the Hamiltonian has random couplings, think about this thing as one of these insertions of the Hamiltonian. This is for p equals 4, and this j is then this random coupling. If you're doing a Gaussian integral, you basically take the Hamiltonian and you try to find another insertion of the Hamiltonian that has exactly the same couplings. This is how you do a Wick contraction in terms of the j Gaussian integral, but that at large n, the Wick contraction between the Majorana oscillators has to follow the same index structure as the J index structure. So you get these, basically these things are called quarts, which you can think of as Wick contractions, but they're actually multiple Wick contractions between the fermions, but they're individual Wick contractions between the Hamiltonians. And then you ask, okay, what happens now if I just do all those Wick contractions? If the Wick contractions don't intersect, then they just multiply. If they do intersect, then you have to worry about the possibility that some of the fermions in one of these Wick contractions is the same fermion as in another one. And then there's a relative minus sign that basically shows up because these are fermions. And it turns out that you can just combinatorically determine how many of these intersections there are. And at large n, and in this double scaling limit, the distribution of the number of intersections turns out to be a Poisson distribution. And then you find out that the intersection between two of these quarts comes with a factor of q, which is this e to the lambda that I introduced. This basically solves the model, meaning at this point I've computed for you all the, at least this is done in this paper 5 years ago, roughly. Where you compute all the moments of the Hamiltonian, and that allows you to compute the spectrum. And it's done in a quite beautiful way. Basically, what you do is the following. Is you actually draw the thermal circle which is the thing I had on the previous slide. You slice it, and you try to associate a state to that slice, and then just count how many lines cross that slice. You define that, you introduce an auxiliary Hilbert space that labels the number of lines crossing that spatial slice by n. Adding a Hamiltonian will either add an extra line, or it can actually reduce it. By doing a Wick contraction, it can make the number of lines one less. But it turns out that you have to keep track of interactions, of crossing lines. And you can organize such things in such a way that adding a line always doesn't come with any intersection, meaning that the adding a line just is adding one of these little arrows here, or at least lines here. But removing a line can have intersections. And then you have to sum the powers of Q for each of those intersections. And that leads to a geometric series, which is that factor. So you can basically find a representation of the Hamiltonian on this, what's called this court Hilbert space, that looks like this. And here I'm writing it sort of as it's called sort of a Q deformed integer, because this is just summing all the powers of Q up to n. Now, this thing looks a little bit like the way the operator x of the harmonic oscillator acts on a number Hilbert space. And that's precisely the algebraic solution of this model, actually, is that you can write this Hamiltonian in the previous slide in the following way, where h is actually the sum of a creation and a relation operator, where a dagger is defined by just raising the n, a is defined by this thing. This is just a slight relabeling of what you would normally do with a harmonic oscillator. And indeed, in Q goes to 1, this reduces to the harmonic oscillator Hilbert space. And in this case, A and A dagger satisfies the raising and lowering commutation relation, but with something that's called a Q commutator, where the Q commutator is defined by A dagger minus Q A dagger A. So that's the definition of the Q commutator. And then you just follow your introductory quantum mechanics book, and you put a Q in front of everything. So you introduce Q Hermite polynomials, and you solve for the spectrum of this theory. And essentially, if you do that, not surprisingly, you actually find that the spectrum of this theory, and it takes the form essentially of a Gaussian. Why is it the Gaussian? The reason is that in this case, what I call the Hamiltonian is what you would normally call the position operator of the harmonic oscillator. A dagger plus A is the position operator. And the ground state of the harmonic oscillator, in this case, defines a density, a probability density in the space of positions. And that probability density in the space of position, in this case, is being interpreted as the energy spectrum of the theory. Another consequence of the Q deformation, the fact that there's this parameter Q in here, is that the spectrum of this operator H is not a real line, which it would be for the ordinary harmonic oscillator. It turns out to be an interval. The spectrum is parameterized by an angle theta. So the two properties of SYK that are quite interesting is that, first of all, the spectrum is parameterized by an angle. It's a finite spectrum. And secondly, the spectral density has a maximum. So that's a property of SYK. And this is already different than you would typically find if you do ADS-CFT, for example, because the SYK model is the analog of the CFT. But now this is the spectrum of the CFT. Ordinarily, in a CFT, you have a spectrum that just keeps growing with energy. In this case, the spectrum, again, cuts off and has a maximum. Another point which I'll make use of in a second is that if the spectral density has a maximum, if you think about the definition of temperature, actually, it will mean that this point is a point of what we call infinite temperature. That's the point where the entropy is maximal. And that's the point where I'm going to be paying attention to. Are there questions at this point? This is my lightning review of 10 years of work on SYK.
Excuse me. What's the meaning of the negative temperature side? You said that's increased temperature. Also a negative temperature.
Yeah, excellent question. It's confusing to have this negative temperature because temperature is indeed defined as differentiating the entropy with respect to energy. Nonetheless, most physical systems have a spectrum that looks like that. Naively, if I would put it indeed in an energy eigenstate around here, then it looks like a point of negative temperature. What's the meaning of that? Again, there are two meanings to that question. One, what does it mean for the SYK system itself? The other question is, what would it mean if I start thinking about the gravity dual to this thing? I'll say a few words about the second interpretation of the question. So at least my proposal is that we should compare this system with gravity in 2 plus 1 dimensions, but not anti-de Sitter gravity, but de Sitter gravity. In gravity, in 2 plus 1 dimensions, it doesn't have any gravitons. It just has solutions to the equations of motion, which in this case is just the constant curvature equation. So locally, indeed, every metric in 2 plus 1 dimensions, if there's no matter at a given location, just looks, the metric locally looks like a constant curvature metric. If you have a pure background, it's an hyperboloid like this. This is pure de Sitter space. Often we look at a subregion of the Sitter space, which we call the static patch, where if you would take an observer in the Sitter space, because the space is first contracting and then expanding, if you look at light rays that can be sent out and received back by this wood line, you only can communicate with the subregion of the Sitter space, which is known as the static patch. And in the Penrose diagram, it sits in that corner. And the fact that this static patch indeed has this edge point here, which is basically the horizon. So that's the bifurcate horizon, and these are two light rays that give you the de Sitter horizon. It's simply the fact that in an expanding universe, indeed, there is an observer horizon. And the fact that there's a horizon with finite area led Gibbons and Hawking to propose that, again, there's an entropy associated with the Sitter space, and that you can even do thermodynamics with the Sitter space. Yes.
So yeah. I was thinking about the number of states, and the SYK model there are exponentially reduced states, but looking at this whole Hilbert space, it seems quite low dimensional.
Yeah, thank you. Very good question. I didn't fully emphasize this, but indeed it turns out that this. So here I wrote down the formula for the spectral density. So there's an overall prefactor, which is rho zero, which in terms of entropy, which because this is e to the power of the entropy, there's an additive constant, which indeed is of order n.
I see, I see. So that part should be viewed as like a function
degeneracy. Correct. So indeed, in this double scaling limit, it's a degeneracy of the spectrum. That's right. And indeed, the thing I would associate with temperature and sort of the thing that kind of is governed by this particular theta function. The theta function, by the way, is essentially a periodic Gaussian. It's a Gaussian function, but then periodically extended. And the magnitude of the theta function is of order 1 over lambda, where lambda is that number p squared over n. Now, the fact that the spectrum is finite actually is one of the properties also of the Sitter gravity, because what happens if I put matter, and again, this is in 2 plus 1 dimensions, so normally if you put matter and you put it in a dense state, you get a black hole. You could have a de Sitter black hole. In 2 plus 1 dimensions, there's a thing called the Schwarzschild de Sitter solution. It's not literally a black hole. Its metric kind of looks black hole-like. But if you look properly at this particular metric, it turns out that it's basically locally the Sitter space, but you can do a redefinition of the coordinates where essentially you see that this thing just has a conical deficit. So it's the Sitter space, but with basically a matter located at the origin, say, and the world line of the matter creates a conical deficit. The magnitude of the conical deficit is proportional to the energy. So what you find actually is that the entropy as a function of energy of the conical deficit, of the mass of the conical deficit, is behaves like this. And here we, by the way, see already a type of behavior which is sort of similar to the negative temperature behavior that was at least a question about a bit earlier. Turns out that S as a function of E actually decreases. It depends a little bit on what you call E. If you call E the energy of the defect, then indeed, in some sense, the Sitter space, indeed, or Schwarzschild the Sitter space, has negative temperature. But you could also maybe think about it the other way around, in some sense that the Sitter space itself has a total amount of energy, and that in some sense we're kind of extracting, we're certainly extracting entropy from the Sitter space whenever we insert something in the Sitter space. So this is another motivation of why actually one should think about the Sitter space as being the maximal entropy state of some system. And every time you put something into it, you reduce the entropy.
But this is a basic question. I'm confused by what happens if the energy is bigger than whatever, 1 over 8 g? Is it that square root or something strange?
Yeah, so what this indicates is that the amount of mass that I can put in the Sitter space has a maximum. So I cannot put an arbitrary amount of energy in the Sitter space.
Physically, what happens?
Simply, there's no such state. So the fact that energy in the Sitter space is bounded, because the square root has to be a positive number, is precisely the feature that we already found in the SYK model itself, where also the energy spectrum is bounded. The other thing, by the way, is that there's a dictionary between energy and a conical deficit. So, and the conical deficit is labeled by an angle, and therefore there's another correspondence between this model, between the gravity and SYK, is that energy is parameterized by an angle. So this is going to be the hint that I want to start using. Another hint that there's a correspondence with SYK comes from the fact that if you do 2+1 gravity, famously at least Witten in the late 80s, reformulate 2+1 gravity as a Chern-Simons theory. And for the case of the Sitter space, the Sitter-Einstein action can indeed be written as essentially an SL2C Chern-Simons theory with a pre-coefficient. And it turns out that pre-coefficient in terms of as a Chern-Simons coupling is actually imaginary. And this A variable, I should have mentioned, indeed is the either the sum or the difference between the dry bind and the spin connection. Now, Chern-Simons theory is known to be, again, topological. If you put it on a manifold with boundary, actually what lives on the boundary is typically an edge mode theory. In the case of SL2C Chern-Simons theory, you can either perhaps formulate that edge mode theory as a SL2C Kac-Moody theory, but it's actually in some sense more natural to choose other boundary conditions so that what sits on the boundary is actually a CFT with Virasoro symmetry. And the Virasoro symmetry is sort of most easily, or at least most compactly, kind of represented by this Lee-Wheel theory. And this theory here precisely indeed looks like the theory I had earlier for the SYK model. And indeed, it turns out, and I should have mentioned this, that the theory that I wrote down in the SYK model indeed had essentially a factor of I in front of the action, the same as here, because the SYK model Lee-Wheel theory was in Lorentzian signature, but actually did not have an I in front of the action. If I would go to Euclidean signature, then it will have an I in front of the action. And why is that important? It turns out that if you look at the central charge that's associated with the Sitter gravity, the CFT, the central charge, is a complex number. And it turns out that the complex number has the following form. It's 13 plus an imaginary piece. And again, why is that interesting? I have here two CFTs, each of which have a real part 13. And they have opposite imaginary parts. So the total central charge of this CFT is C equals 26. Sounds familiar. And indeed, it's very natural to think about this thing essentially as a topological theory or a two-dimensional gravity theory, and that one should think about this as a theory where you have to impose Virasoro conditions. So that's at least a comment about the 2 plus 1 gravity theory, and it hints at a connection with SYK. So can we make this more precise? So now I've started with SYK. I made a few comments about 2 plus 1 gravity. Again, this is a good moment to ask questions, because now I'm going to connect the two sides more precisely. So the idea is to try to find observables in the SYK model that have a precise correspondence with the observables in the Sitter gravity. And let me still make one comment about the Sitter gravity. So in 2 plus 1 dimensions, again, you can do ADS CFT. And then the CFT lives on the boundary of an ADS space-time. And then we have a relatively clean dictionary, which is the GKPW dictionary between boundary correlation functions of the CFT and basically computations you can do in the gravity, which are boundary-to-boundary correlation functions. The boundary of the Sitter space lives in the future and in the past. I would like to make a holographic dictionary where I can identify the Hilbert space of the gravity theory with the Hilbert space of the SYK model. And then it's not so natural to put the CFT on the future or past boundary, because then I don't know how to map Hilbert spaces. Time goes up here. I would like to identify that time with a time variable in the SYK model. So I'm going to give you a heads up. My SYK model will essentially live on this blue line. And indeed, I'm going to give evidence that a two-point function in the SYK model, appropriately defined, will correspond to a two-point function in the Sitter space defined on this world line. There have been recently some papers about the Sitter gravity, indeed, where people are taking this particular perspective, where essentially one tries to define an operator algebra associated with an observer on a world line in the Sitter space. And it seems that SYK kind of connects with that perspective. How am I doing with time? I'm sort of halfway. Yeah, okay, good. I think I'm on track. So in the second half of the, or at least in the remaining half hour then, I'll do two things. I'll describe how to, I'll give you basically the answer for the two-point function in SYK appropriately defined. And I'm going to show that it actually matches with the two-point function in the bulk of the Sitter space. That's one thing I'm going to do. The second thing I'm going to do, I'm going to make a match between the computation that you would do in gravity to compute the spectrum of the theory, and I'm going to match that with the spectrum of the SYK model. So again, I'm going to make two links between SYK and the gravity side. So this is the first match. In part because this theory in gravity that I had here was a C equals 26 theory, if I would want to take an expectation value in this particular theory, what I would do, I would write down a vertex operator in this theory, and I would require that it commutes with the Virasoro constraint, because that's sort of what this theory looks like. And typically, if you have a vertex operator that commutes with Virasoro constraints, we call them gravitationally dressed. They would have to be a sum of an operator in this theory times an operator in that theory, such that the total conformal dimension is equal to 1, or 1 comma 1, so that I can write it as a physical operator in the gravitational theory. So with that motivation, what I'm going to do is I'm basically going to double the SYK model, where I have two copies of it. I'll call it a left and a right model, and I impose that the two sides have the same energy. So indeed, I have sort of the analog of a Virasoro condition, which is that the two have the same energy. at that point, I've not done nothing with the spectrum of the theory, because to energy eigenstates, I can always associate then a state which is the tensor product of the left and the right energy eigenstate. And that I'm just simply going to call the energy eigenstate of the combined model. One way of thinking about it, this is sort of how Witten introduced sort of a similar setup, is that in the Sitter space, you always need a clock. And in this case, I'm just saying, hey, I have one SYK model, and I'm using the other SYK model as my clock of measuring time. The combined model still has the same spectrum as the previous, as the individual model, because, as I mentioned, and as I also mentioned before, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take to the Sitter vacuum to be the state that lives at the point of maximal entropy, that lives over here. It happens to be that this point is the point where the energy is zero, where this cosine is equal to zero. By the way, this lambda times S should have been called theta. It's the parameter that I called theta before. So when the cosine is zero, I'm sitting at this point, and that's my state in which I'm going to take expectation values. And I claim that that's going to be the thing that will behave like the Sitter space. Physical operators should commute with this equal energy constraint that I had imposed. And one way of doing that is to simply take an operator on one side, take an operator on the other side, multiply them, and integrate them over time. But it turns out, of course, that I can displace one operator relative to the other. So indeed, the difference of the two Hamiltonians commutes with O, but the sum of the two Hamiltonians still acts. And that gives me an extra time dependence still that I can keep track of. It turns out, just a side comment for later reason, that I'm going to actually choose two types of operators. And let me sort of explain this a little bit. It turns out that maybe I should postpone this question, this comment a little bit, but since I'm now already talking about it. Basically, these operators O that I'm defining here, it turns out that in some sense they live in the following location. So normally, if you double the Hilbert space, often we think about this in terms of a thermal field double, where we consider two copies of the system, and each of them are living on the opposite side of what we call the thermal circle. So the thermal field double can be written as half a thermal circle. It turns out that these operators, and that's just empirically, essentially turn out to live here, sort of here. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to introduce an operator O plus that lives transported with a quarter thermal circle to the right. I'm going to introduce an operator O minus that lives over here. And I'm going to study the two-point function. So this is my definition of the operator. And I'm going to construct the matrix of two-point functions. Sorry? Yeah, so what is delta? Good question. So in SYK, the Hamiltonian, let me do it schematically, is J times psi to the P. That's what the Hamiltonian looks like. If I have an operator O delta in the same schematic notation, it looks like K to psi to the P prime, but K is again a set of random couplings. And P prime over P is delta. They sum up to one. A priori, my physical state condition didn't require me to do it. The correspondence with this Liouville theory suggests that I should do it. And also, it turns out the answers look much nicer if I do it that way. The other thing I should say is that there's a symmetry algebra in SYK that people have constructed, Lin and Stanford. And it turns out that these O's transform under a certain representation of the symmetry algebra. And it turns out that delta and 1 minus delta have the same value of the Casimir of that symmetry algebra. So in some sense, you can think about one of them as the mirror operator of the other one, or the shadow operator. So it's true, from the point of view of SYK, it's maybe not 100% clear why I would take delta times 1 minus delta, but it turns out to be the most natural combination.
So these are essentially made out of N, of P.
Yeah, but indeed, right. The total is again P fermions, but now I've distributed the P fermions among the two sides.
So it almost feels like if you're integrating them over time, you're considering infinitesimal deformation of the SYK Hamiltonian.
Right.
I'm mixing.
Yeah. So I still think indeed these are a natural class of operators, but indeed there should be maybe a more invariant way of characterizing why these are the ones, the most natural ones to look at. At that point, you basically just go to the literature and you look at what the correlation functions of those things look like, and you can compute it. Turns out that you can write it completely explicitly if you go into energy space. So you Fourier transform that object, you introduce an energy, a Tupper function in energy space. Turns out that in the SYK model, you get an answer that looks like that. Again, lambda times S is a labeling of the energy, and it's expressed in terms of theta functions. It turns out that this same expression actually showed up in papers by Samolodchikov when he was studying the Liouville theory precisely that I had previously on the slide. So this expression, at least I kind of knew, would be connecting SYK with gravity, but in this case it's just purely an SYK computation. And indeed, if you now take the semi-classical limit, and I should have emphasized this, I didn't do this properly yet. So there is this number lambda, and the number lambda actually showed up as the coupling constant of the Liouville theory. It also shows up as the coupling constant of the Chern-Simons theory. So lambda, in terms of G Newton, it turns out that lambda is actually 8 pi G Newton if I take the correspondence through the Liouville theory seriously. So the lambda to zero limit is the G Newton to zero limit. And that's the limit where I should just recover quantum field theory. So I take my answer, I take lambda to zero. Turns out that this G of E looks like that, where omega is the difference in the energy between E and the thing that I called E zero. Mu labels delta. I can do the Fourier transform, and I get this answer. And the moment where I realized that this was actually a good answer was indeed when I was studying a paper by Strominger, Busso, and Maloney of a long time ago, 20 years ago, where they actually studied Green's functions in De Sitter space. And it turns out that this thing is indeed a Green's function in De Sitter space, which I'll explain in a second. So indeed, I take the SYK two-point function, I compute the Green's function, the two-point function, and it turns out to be the Green's function. This Green's function, by the way, turns out to be the Green's function between a point in De Sitter space and a point on the other side of the horizon in De Sitter space. So this is what's called the antipodal Green's function. This is the Green's function on the same world line, where tau is the proper time distance between the two points. So it's the Green.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Is this related to the fraction of time?
The direction of time in the Sitter space is a subtle question to some extent, because if you're sitting at some point in the Sitter space, time goes up where you are. At least that's one definition of the arrow of time, I guess, locally. But then if you go to the other side of the horizon, the killing vector that goes up in time here goes down in time on the other side. In this case, right, the I pi here, the I pi shift, the e to the I pi is precisely the amount of time that I need to propagate to go from one point to the other, from between the two sides. So the e to the I pi is precisely the thing that brings me from this point to that point in the thermal circle. And this is one side of the set of space, and this is the opposite side of the set of space. So if you go in the Euclidean time direction, you can actually find yourself being able to go between the two sides of the Okay.
I have a question. You connect that to thermofield level, Masaru's formula, which is used for non-equilibrium infinity. So in your context, you have SVP level. Is there any interpretation in terms of non-equilibrium?
In terms of real time? Yeah, I'm sort of pragmatic on this on this point. It's true that the preparation of a thermofield double state involves naturally a Euclidean path integral. I'll be honest, my calculation, the way I did it at the time was I had identified this class of operators that commute with the Hamiltonian. I had to do a Fourier transform of the thing that I knew how to compute from SYK. And when we did the Fourier transform, the answer looked like this. Ideally, what you would have liked to find was that actually that this thing was indeed a Green's function. But it turns out that this is what we call the antipodal Green's function. And indeed, as you can see, as a function of tau, when tau is 0, this thing is regular. So it's not a Green function that blows up at coincident points. And then it's just a fact that in the Sitter space, if you look at the two-point function, that the two-point function which is not antipodal, namely which is a two-point function that lives on the same side, looks like this. And this thing indeed becomes singular when tau goes to 0. So if you want to go from here to there, you force yourself basically to be able to transport between opposite sides of the thermal field double. But it turns out that this Green's function is what I call the off-diagonal Green's function. So strangely enough, this plus and that minus index means that this is the two-point function between seemingly an operator that lives here and an operator that lives there. And I'll explain that in a second. So there's some kind of funny antipodal identification that also interchanges the plus and the minus fields.
Is it possible that the Sitter has been more quotient than Bezier-Schulte?
Yeah, right. So let me be very quick here, because I do want to get to the second part of the talk. And there's a lot of information in my talk, I realize this. So try to just take it sort of in a slightly impressionistic way. So the interpretation of this two-point function is the following. Suppose I would take initially a two-dimensional gravity theory, and I write down the two-dimensional gravity theory like that. If I would, by the way, write down this two-dimensional gravity theory in the conformal gauge, it would indeed look like a difference of two, or a sum of two Liouville theories. If I look at the classical solutions to this equation, it turns out that with the appropriate definition of the metric, indeed I have a de Sitter background solution in the as of this theory. There's also this field which is a dilaton, and a dilaton looks like that in the classical solution of that theory. I prefer to interpret these two fields combined as a parameterization of a three-dimensional metric, where this thing is the two-dimensional component, and then there's an extra component where e to the phi is being interpreted as the prefactor of this metric, this component. And this turns out to be three-dimensional de Sitter space. So I think about this maybe as a dimensional reduction of three-dimensional de Sitter space. If I now take a scalar field in three dimensions, and I couple it to the three-dimensional metric, and I then dimensionally reduce it in the way with the parameterization that I used on the previous slide, I get a theory that lives in two dimensions. It's a massive scalar field, but it's a charged field. There's a plus field and a minus field. I can compute the Green's function and the Green's function of this theory indeed looks like I had before. In terms of pictures, the way to think about it is that I had these operators O plus and A minus. O plus creates a positively charged field here, and it can annihilate the field over there. O minus can annihilate the field that was created here on the same side. So indeed, this two-point function will have a singularity when the two points come close to each other. So that's what I call G plus minus. This two-point function will not have a singularity when tau 2 and tau 1 coincide because they stay on opposite sides. So that's sort of the interpretation. And indeed, then what one can do is one can essentially restrict everything just to half of the Sitter space simply by taking a quotient. In principle, one can do that. Let me still mention this thing here. One of the reasons for why, from the point of view of SYK, it's actually kind of exciting that this is the two-point function, is that there's an important difference between the Sitter space and anti-de Sitter space. If you look at what's called quasi-normal modes, in the Sitter space, there are actually two towers of quasi-normal modes. There's a tower that's associated with delta, and there's delta plus an imaginary, plus an integer. So you have two towers of quasi-normal modes in the Sitter space. In anti-de Sitter space, you would only have one. And it's sort of essential that I'm having this both delta and 1 minus delta to be able to reproduce this expansion. By the way, this thing also looks like a character of something if you view it as a Q expansion. Okay, here, let me just skip very quickly over this thing. If I have a two-point function, indeed, and it has periodicity in time, which it does, then there's a temperature associated with it. And that's actually slightly mysterious, because I told you that from the point of view of SYK, I'm sitting at the point of infinite temperature. Nonetheless, it turns out that the corresponding two-point function has a finite periodicity in time. And therefore, it actually looks like a two-point function in a system with finite temperature. And then it actually seems as if if you use the second law of thermodynamics, if I have a two-point function that experiences a finite temperature, then there's a simple thermodynamic argument that tells you that a detector that interacts with that two-point function will see an environment with a finite temperature and with a finite entropy, meaning that the Boltzmann factor is defined to be the difference between the entropies. And therefore, entropy will change in a certain way with respect to energy. And it turns out that this indeed matches with the Sitter thermodynamics. The surprise, perhaps, though, is that when I mentioned this formula, someone might have objected. Lambda is actually a dimensionless quantity. This thing is in terms of the Sitter radius units. So this is actually the formula. And it turns out, indeed, that the correspondence works if we identify this number lambda with this particular ratio between G Newton and the AdS radius. Okay, in the last 10 minutes, I'll do something else. Let's see if I can do this thing. I'm going to connect with the first part of my talk. In the first part of my talk, I described how to compute the spectrum of the SYK model by doing these Wick contractions between the Hamiltonian. Hamiltonians. And there was this operator that I introduced that could create and annihilate these courts. And there was this algebraic description in terms of this was called the Q-deformed harmonic oscillator. The question is, can I use the gravity theory to reproduce that structure? Okay. I also mentioned that the spectrum of the SYK model is parameterized by an angle which I call theta. And it's very suggestive to try to identify theta with the deficit angle that you get if I put energy in this interspace. So the question is, can I match the SOK spectrum by thinking about the geometry of the sitter space associated with a conical deficit? Okay. So in the next 10 minutes, I'll tell you how that works. Now, here I already indicated sort of an operator that I call LA. This operator will play an important role. If I'm doing 2 plus 1 gravity, and I'm, say, an observer that sits here, and there's mass located at the center. By the way, this is a picture of what's called the static patch. I have some object that sits in the middle. It has a certain amount of mass. This is the horizon. And if I go around the horizon is no longer 2 pi, but it's 2 pi minus a deficit angle. So one way of measuring that mass is indeed to consider a gravitational Wilson line, if you wish, that measures the length of the horizon. That's an operator, and I want to compute the spectrum of that operator. And indeed, I'm going to identify this operator with, at least in the holographic dictionary, with the Hamiltonian of the SYK model. That's the idea. In terms of other pictures, let me actually skip this for now. The previous picture was clearly enough. Let me explain briefly what my operator looks like. So what I have to do, I have to take the sitter space and I have to quantize the sitter space. That's maybe where the previous slide was actually useful. I have to quantize this, gravity. And the way I'm going to quantize gravity is as follows. So here's a picture. This is three-dimensional. The sit space, it's a Penrose diagram. And I'm going to define for you what my quantum mechanical Hilbert space looks like by giving you a phase space. And the phase space will consist, indeed, of the operator that measures the conical deficit, the one that I showed on the previous slide. And I have an other observable that connects the north and the south pole. So if I indicated that I'm going to be putting a mass at the origin of the static patch, the origin of the static patch I'm going to call this the north pole. And in the sitter space, then there's an antipodal point, which is the south pole. And I have to basically put the same mass there as well, because the conical deficit that I measure on the equator is the same for the north pole and for the south pole. So I'm going to have a two-dimensional phase space. Basically, one variable is this LA variable, and the other variable is basically a variable that measures, in some sense, the distance or the time difference, if you wish, between the north pole and the south pole. Yes?
So in the language of flat connections, to define these sort of open whistle lines, I would need a little line there, right?
Correct.
Is this somehow the pencil observer or whatever?
Right. Correct. So these blue lines, although I didn't quite indicate it, in some ways these are anchors on which I can have that Wilson line end. So there's sort of some trivalent vertex that basically, or at least something that allows me to glue that line to that line.
Okay.
But in terms of the Hilbert space, I slice this thing. By the way, this is this sphere is the spatial slice. It didn't quite draw that way. So this is what space looks like. And I have the space of flat connections on the sphere with a possible singularity at the north and the south pole, and that's it.
Cool.
And I'm now just going to quantize that thing.
That's it, within the specific level.
Yeah.
Because if you worked in hash to color and dust things, where you had just discrete places where the measurement, where you had measure and you could then perform the multiple parameters.
Right. So the idea that I'm going to describe here actually did appear in previous literature, and it's both in two dimensions and maybe, I think, also in the Ashtekar language. And it, from the Ashtekar point of view, it's actually quite natural to identify the Hamiltonian with a gravitational Wilson line. In this case, the eigenvalues of the gravitational Wilson line are an angle. So one funny thing that seems to be happening is that time will be naturally discrete. If the energy is an angle, then time would be discrete. But we'll see that appearing in a second. Okay, I'm going to briefly just the next two slides, or four slides, I'll give you two ways of actually defining these two variables. One is just in terms of transition functions. The other one is in terms of Wilson lines, basically.
I do have a question. So if these are S2C connections, right, these will be normal operators. They wouldn't be, so you look at a complex space, or you're taking a real slice, like you're saying.
I'm taking a real slice where I need L and L bar are the same. And I'll give you the reality condition in a second.
Okay. So it's possible that there is this part of the often C2 quotient that is kind
right.
of the geometry.
Right. The Z2 quotient is one of those subtle points where you have to find the correct way of taking the Z2 quotient. I'll give you a proposal in one slide. This is again 3D de Sitter space. 3D de Sitter space is the space of 2x2 matrices with determinant equal to 1. Indeed, it has an isometry. That's SL2C. But I'm going to take indeed a C2 quotient. I'm basically going to break the SL2C symmetry to SU11 by introducing a matrix dot matrix. And this is sort of some kind of PT symmetry. You can think about it geometrically. Turns out that in the isometries then has to satisfy this requirement, which indeed defines SU11. The reason I actually need it, it turns out that I want to be able to define another trace than the usual trace. I'm going to define the trace including this matrix J. This is a good definition of the trace for SU11.
I guess what you wanted is this hyperspace. Is it a discrete series representation, right? It could have formed discrete series representations.
Later on. So one way of thinking about this sort of these variables indeed that I introduce here, the L and the as traces of a holonomy, that if I go around a loop, I come back up to a symmetry transformation. And that symmetry transformation is an element of SU11, and I can take the trace of that thing. That gives me an observable. In the case of going around the equator, I have a conical deficit. If I go between the north and the south pole, I basically have a time shift. And I can associate corresponding physical observables, one by taking the trace, which is in the sine of the deficit angle, or I can just keep track of the time shift. Alternatively, I could do the whole thing in terms of the Chern-Simons formulation. I'll not go into detail too much here. I explained that you can have the spin connection and the dry bind, combine them in a Chern-Simons field. If I write the 3D de Sitter metric like that, then this is what the spin connection and the dry bind look like. I can compute the corresponding Wilson line, and again, I get the same observables. So this is how I'm thinking about the observables. And so this is the dictionary that the Hamiltonian of SYK has this spectrum. I claim that the gravity theory should have a spectrum of this operator LA, which measures the deficit angle. And I want to identify these two things with each other. The cosine of theta is the sine of pi times alpha. And there's this factor of square root of 1 minus q here. OK. 2 minutes?
Sure.
3 minutes. Okay, so now I'm going to compute the spectrum of this guy. First, I do classical geometry. So quantizing the space of flat connections is an old, well-studied art. There are papers by going back to who was the first one to start doing? Basically, to Chern-Simons theory. Then in the context of Teichmuller theory, it was Kashayev and Fock, and later Fock and Goncharov. And Davide has done a lot of work on this. And basically, there's a structure that comes out of this, where basically you triangulate the geometry that you want to quantize, at least whose flat connections you want to quantize. So basically, and the way I'm going to do that is as follows. I have this picture here. This is the north and the south pole. This is the equator. This is the line between the north and the south pole. And I'm going to map this thing, which I think about as, say, a map of the Earth. And I'm going to map it to an actual map, meaning where I do the thing that people do in an atlas, where the north pole is now stretched to a line. Right, so I do the Mercator projection, if you wish. So this line here, this North Pole line, just goes around the North Pole. This is the line between the North and the South Pole. The equator sits here. So these top three lines are three ways of triangulating, at least these two lines are three ways of triangulating the sphere with two punctures. It turns out that classically there's a theorem which is known as the Ptolemy theorem, which is a version of Pythagoras, basically, that tells you that if you multiply that length z times that length LA, that you basically get the sum of the product. You have various relations. If I multiply that thing times that thing, I get the sum of the product of the length of the sides. That's the Ptolemy theorem. There's another version of the Ptolemy theorem that's basically this one. And it turns out that what I need to do is I need to basically quantize this classical fact in geometry by including the commutator between the gauge fields. Gauge fields in Jeune-Simons theory don't commute because Jeune-Simons theory have a kinetic term that dictates a commutation relation between the gauge components. And it means that the Wilson lines that are measuring these lengths don't commute. And actually, they satisfy something that's called the Skene relation, that a Wilson line that intersects, if I multiply them, they can actually be re-expressed if these Wilson lines are in the spin 1/2 representation as a sum of two products of Wilson lines where they no longer intersect. So this is actually the way of quantizing the theory. And the quantization, the deformation parameter, is this parameter Q, which I'm identifying again here. So this leads to what's called an Q-deformed Ptolemy theorem. And since I'm kind of out of time, it turns out that this Q-deformed Ptolemy theorem, which I had over here, and I'm going to sprinkle in some Q factors in this equation, essentially can be repackaged in terms of the Q-deformed harmonic oscillator that I had in the previous, in the beginning of my talk. Again, here I put the Qs in the various places, and this Skene relation that's interesting to me, I want to compute LA, I multiply times LZ, and I can rewrite it in terms of these two Wilson lines by indeed cutting open this thing here. And then if you combine that with the Ptolemy relation, you indeed find that you can repackage the operator precisely in the way that gives you the correspondence with the SYK structure, that the commutation relations that I had in the previous slide can be repackaged in terms of Q-deformed harmonic oscillators through this particular identification, where indeed there's a combination of Wilson lines that gives me a dagger. There's another combination of Wilson lines that gives me A, and indeed the geometric relation that follow from quantizing this space can be repackaged in terms of these harmonics. At this point, I'm sort of done, presuming that indeed I can introduce a variable, and I should have mentioned that this variable that goes between the North and the South Pole, I'm writing it like that, and I'm going to assume, and this is not something I've derived, that the spectrum of this thing is discrete. And if it's discrete, then indeed I can reproduce the spectrum of the SYK model.
It can be derived.
It should probably be derivable because indeed this thing is dual to some kind of angular variable. That's right. Okay, let me summarize basically, I didn't tell you too much about this side of the story, where there's actually more to be told as well. But I've kind of given you a bunch of indications that there is indeed this connection. I computed the two-point function here for appropriate observables. Turns out that basically there's a symmetry algebra in SYK that indeed in the Q to 1 limit matches with the symmetry algebra of the De Sitter space. So to me, at least, this is a structure where basically up to now, there are a few people that have started looking at it. I think it's a very big kind of web of connections. And there's quite a bit of work to do into making this dictionary kind of fit together. I've only sort of indicated a few pieces of a puzzle. And I think it would be exciting to really work this out and make this really into a well-established dictionary. Thank you. So, as you know, right, defining local operators in gravity have that same feature. There's essentially a gravitational Gauss law constraint that forces you to kind of always include the back reaction of whatever you're doing. So the two-point function, for example, that I wrote down of the SYK, two-point function, still had this parameter q in there. So the SYK model itself is not sitting on some boundary where gravity is turned off. It sits on the fluctuating Wilson line itself. That sounds scary in general, and this is one of the reasons for why people have not been able to do CFT in general, because how do you know how to include quantum gravity? But it so happens that in 2 plus 1 dimensions, we kind of know how to include quantum gravity. And it turns out that the SYK, the double-scaled SYK model, is doing this. I saw one other.
You showed that the Gaussian distributed space. There are other random matrix models, if I remember correctly. They also have Gaussian distributed. Is there a message to do something?
That's a good question. Of course, the most famous matrix model is the semicircle. There is a limit where this thing goes to the semicircle, which is the q to zero limit. So if I send q to zero, this turns into the semicircle. Q to one is another special limit. Generally, this goes by the name of at least the q to zero limit is called free probability theory. And actually, the algebraic structure that I have here was studied already by mathematicians in the 80s. It has appeared in many places. So people actually have studied the Hilbert space, this Hilbert space structure quite. But it's apparently no one yet has been able to connect this spectrum with a matrix model. But people are making progress on it.
That's
a very good question also. It turns out that some of the structure, and indeed I got an email even yesterday of someone who redid this calculation in the lambda to zero limit first, at least the two-point function results. Turns out that the two-point function match can be done by first taking the lambda to zero limit. I'll be honest, where the reason why I get confused is that the lambda to zero limit is the q to one limit. I explained that the SYK model is the q deformed harmonic oscillator. The q to one limit of the q deformed harmonic oscillator is the harmonic oscillator. It turns out that there are structures here that I cannot all grab out of the harmonic oscillator. Although, if I take two harmonic oscillators, I can build an SU11 algebra out of it. So in some cases, you can first take the lambda to zero limit and still reproduce the full structure. In other questions, it seems that keeping lambda first finite and then taking lambda to zero at the end is sort of the appropriate way.
Questions?
Scattering?
Yeah,
so a lot of people have asked me this question. In entering the scatter space, especially again with the connection with SYK, the reason why SYK was discovered kind of was that it has maximal chaos. And then indeed the out of time ordered correlation functions indeed have the appropriate structure to match what you would expect from gravity and the shockwave interaction near a black hole horizon. In the scatter space, so in the case of entering the scatter space, if I have a in and an outgoing particle, basically the ingoing particle pushes the outgoing particle behind the horizon, so you get a time delay. And the Penrose diagram of two shockwaves stretches in the spatial direction. In the scatter space, it works the other way around. What's happening in the scatter space is that if you don't include back reaction, it's not possible to send the signal from the North Pole to the South Pole because the South Pole sits on the other side of the horizon. If you do include back reaction and you send a signal at the same time from the North Pole and the South Pole, it can actually make it to the other side because the shockwave works the other way around. Turns out that shockwaves in the scatter space open up the horizon. So things stretch in this way. So it would be interesting to actually study that in this context. It's subtle, at least in the first part of my talk, it's subtle to do that because of the fact that the operators that I had defined were basically this convolution product. I should say, though, the fact that this is the sitter gravity has to do with the shockwave interaction, because the way gravity interacts in 2 plus 1 dimensions is just by conical deficits. It's just by braiding. So the shockwaves are just basically consequence of braiding. And the type of gravitational interaction in the sitter space is governed by this parameter q. And it turns out that in entering the sitter space, this q is actually a phase. So in entity set space, all the same things work, but then q is a phase. And in the scatter space, q is a real number. So I haven't been able to do that computation yet, but it certainly would be interesting to do that, to look at that.
I have a question. So I find fascinating the idea of realizing the observer essentially as an irregular singularity in the flat connection. Did this appear before, or is this the first time these irregular singularities are used in quantum gravity perspective?
I don't know yet. The idea to some extent is indeed that
around 1/2 irregular singularity.
Right.
Why?
Yeah, I'll be honest. Indeed, the idea of equating LA to the Hamiltonian came indeed by thinking exactly what's the observable that would measure the holonomy around a singularity.
But this is what bigger singularities only have the holonomy. You wouldn't be able to have something ending on the regular singularities like conical defects or things like that. Here there is a bit more, right? There is the possibility of ending with somebody. It's around 1/2 irregular singularity. There's a Stokes line there or something like that. Maybe a little interesting
hole. Right.
holographic screen of some sort. It's like very, very. It's a more singular than usual thing. Going.
Yeah, it's a good comment. I'll be honest. The reason why something needs to be happening on the North and the South Pole is because you have to be able to find a variable that's conjugate to that. And then somehow, you do something on those locations. And it's a very natural place to locate a Hilbert space. So maybe what you call the irregular singularity is then indeed what would be the natural holographic screen in this setting. That's right.
Any more questions? Can take this bit again.